Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey. You're listening to High Performance, our gift to you for free every single week. If you can subscribe and rate this podcast, please do. It makes a huge difference to us. As many of you know by now, this podcast turns the lived experiences of the planet's highest performers into your life lessons. So right now, just pause and allow myself and Professor Damien Hughes to speak to the greatest leaders, thinkers, sports stars and entrepreneurs on the planet for you, so they can become your teacher. Remember, this podcast is not about high achievement or high success. It's about high happiness and taking you closer to a life of fulfillment, empathy and understanding. Today on the High Performance Podcast, this awaits you.
How old are we? 22, 23, back then, however old it was. Things that I enjoyed doing were making music, DJing, maybe DJing my tunes out in a nightclub. So you fast forward 19 years. What do I enjoy doing? Making music, DJing, playing my tunes in a nightclub. What do I do every weekend? Exactly that.
Part of that is the sort of competitive nature in us. And I don't really know where that comes from. I can't place it in myself.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's inbuilt, you know.
But they were very ambitious, and it wasn't like let's just try and do well. It was let's be the absolute best.
Self-doubt and questioning. Every session we go to, if it's for someone else, and we've made a whole load of beats beforehand, I'm anxious, thinking, man,
they're not going to like this. Terrible. Yeah, we're no
what
one.
If,
yeah,
what, if,
yeah.
What if these 12 songs that we spent ages making are garbage and we're totally out of sync?
We've always forced each other and ourselves just to always, always turn up. And that means sort of metaphorically and physically.
So today we talk to Will and Saul, two men who created Chase and Status. And they talk about their passion when they were younger. They talk about the doubts from their friends and their family. They talk about the fact it would have been so much easier to give up on their dream. Now, what about hard work? Where does hard work and high performance come together? Saul talks really passionately and really deeply about obsession, almost to the point of it being an illness. But this conversation I know is going to be valuable to you. And let me just remind you, it doesn't matter if you're not even a fan of their music. It doesn't matter if you come to this podcast for business people or sports people or entertainers or entrepreneurs. The key for these conversations is to come to them with a growth mindset, with an open mind, because there will be things right now that Will and Saul, Chase and Status, will say that will change the way you see the world. It's a conversation that is full of value, so please enjoy it. Don't forget, you can also watch these episodes. We'd love it if you would go to our YouTube channel, just type in High Performance, subscribe, and you can watch as well as listen. And I think you see a little bit more when you actually see the whites of people's eyes while they're talking about the things they have passion for. And that is really the center of today's conversation. Passion without hard work is just passion. Hard work without passion is just hard work. And Will and Saul are living, breathing reminders of what happens when you mix passion with real, genuine, deep hard work. So thanks very much for coming along. It's time to get you closer to your own version of high performance. Today's episode with Chase and Status comes next.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless, when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data
for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to the overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Well, Will, Sol, thank you so much for joining us on High Performance. Let's start, as we always do, with what is your definition of high performance? And for the first time, we get two answers, not just one.
Yeah, I wonder if you have different answers. God, big question. I think for me, I mean, obviously we perform in the literal sense, but as artists, as recording artists and performers on the stage, but I think just in general, for artists, for what we do, the ability to kind of create original ideas which have some kind of intrinsic value is the real difficulty of what we do. Anyone that can do that operates probably at a high level.
I guess it's obviously extremely subjective, but and I guess it would just kind of fall into my kind of obsessive mind anyhow, but just whatever you set your mind to or your goals, just making sure that you put everything you can into it to achieve it. And that starts at an early age. And obviously, as you get older, you know, that kind of, the amount that you can do that changes. And you realize you don't have to do things like 24/7. But yeah, I definitely think having a goal and making sure you achieve it every single time, and then setting more goals. It's constant addition of goals means your performance will always stay high, and then you never just rest on your laurels. Because when you start doing that, any kind of performance in any vicinity starts to waver.
Mm. This is good, Sol. Sounds like you're building a journey to me. So we're going to let's delve into that journey. And let's start, you know, Sol mentioned there early on about it starts at a young age. So let's go right back to, you know, when you first realized that you both had an affinity and a natural ability at this, but then you were able to tap into the obsession to make it a success. Because without hard work, we don't get anywhere. So can we talk, first of all, about this relationship? Because this is a unique thing.
Two of us.
Yeah, few people find this that you two have found. Yeah. What was special about it?
Well, I mean, look, you mentioned the word obsessed. That's definitely why probably we sort of met in the first place, because mutual friends and through a mutual love.
/obsession.
Obsession of dance music, electronic music, British music culture in like the 90s when we were growing up. Yeah, we, you know, everyone likes music when you're growing up. All of my mates were kind of into music and stuff. But when you meet someone else with a kind of almost verging on a sort of sickness, rather than just an obsession, you just kind of recognize it in that person quite quickly. And you connect with them, I guess, on a slightly different level than maybe just your average music fan. And that's, I guess, what kept us in contact through growing up in London and then going off to University of Manchester, and just coincidentally being there at the same time and bumping into each other and sort of reconnecting through that obsession of just music and culture and the things we were into at the time.
You've both used quite strong terminology, obsession or a sickness, which almost has a negative connotation to what some people might describe as passion.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it does sound negative, doesn't it?
Because, you know, the thing about obsession, which I personally am guilty of with pretty much anything I'm into, like I am crazy into it. And sometimes I might be into something like insane for a period of time and then I'll stop. Like I've collected vintage Moschino. I think I've got the largest personal collection in the world and I've like completed that game now. So I've stopped collecting it every week and like sourcing it and like rummaging around, you know. But like, that's gone on since we were kids, you know. So it's always these obsessions that have basically like driven everything I do.
But let's talk about it positively then. What has the obsession done for you?
It's meant that everything we try and do, we achieve it. You know, we make sure it happens one way or another. Like if we didn't manage to stumble across some success in music, I have no idea where it'd be, where I'd be. You know, it's like it was nothing else. I think what we were talking about, like the obsession connection between us, we were like also when we both went to Manchester separately, a year between each other, we clearly both gone there. It was like, we're going here because we're going to uni and we're getting away from our parents and blah, 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 and it's fun. But I'm not going to be a, what am I doing? Philosophy and humanity. I'm not doing this stuff. I want to be a jungle DJ. Are you mad? You know, like, this is what I want to be. And then, you know, reconnecting with someone up there who's clearly got the same mindset, the same dream. Because I think we both had friends who were also DJs, bedroom DJs, really good at it as well, like better than us at some stage. And like, might have shown us a few things. We're like, wow, the earth. But it was us who went on to be completely besotted with it. I think it's also we fell in love with it. You know, we fall in love with these things we're obsessed with.
I think the sickness thing is just because it sort of takes over everything you do, really, and I guess gets hold of you a bit, like, you know, when you're very sick, you're kind of consumed with an illness. So it's not really, it's not meant to sound negative, but it's definitely all consuming. And at the time, it's all we did and talked about. Our entire lives were built around our obsession with music.
And how do you nurture that then? So it becomes a positive thing rather than something that,
well,
because you can think of it like an addiction.
Yeah,
but it's something we love.
Well,
though.
So what you realize is at some point you need to earn a living, and so you either quit your obsession and get into the real world of making money, or you try and turn your obsession into making money, and that's how you nurture it, and that's when things get serious, and it goes from being a thing that you have a laugh with your mates and, you know, you sort of endlessly chatting about, to how the hell are we going to turn this into a viable career that will pay for us to live and exist and even in the future pay for our kids to go to school and all this kind of stuff. And that's when it goes from, I guess, an obsession into a profession.
Yeah.
And which what are your memories then of that period? Because it goes from being fun to actually being much more serious, probably. And then that increases the pressure, that increases the obsession. And
yeah,
it's a snowball, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's also quite surreal in the sense that it's in one regard, it hasn't changed. Because I was saying this to my wife the other day, which is like, when I was, how old are we, 22, 23, back then, however old it was, things that I enjoyed doing were making music, DJing, maybe DJing my tunes out in a nightclub. So you fast forward 19 years. What do I enjoy doing? Making music, DJing, playing my tunes in a nightclub. What do I do every weekend? Exactly that. So it's like, in some regards, I'm still in the exact same place we were when we were like desperately trying to like break it, break out and come through. Because we're still in that cycle of doing the same things we love so much. Whereas friends of mine will be like, oh, mate, oof, not seen Dex for a long time. It's been a long time since I DJed. You know, I remember the days, and I'm like, remember the days? I'm going DJing tonight. You know, it's like, it's still stuck there in that regard. So,
yeah.
But there's so many people listening to this that I reckon would be going, that they've heard that saying that, you know, find a job you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thinking, but I don't know what I love.
Yeah.
So, how did you guys discover that this is a passion that you could?
Well, it did become a job, and you know, it isn't always, you know, you don't always love everything you're doing, and that point of, you know, dropping out of uni and realizing, you know, we haven't got a pot to piss in, we're gonna be working in a shoe shop unless we turn this into a viable sort of money making option, that does add stress, and you know, suddenly you are putting yourselves in difficult positions and situations, and
you've got any money.
You have to start plotting. You become very strategic. Well, we became very strategic, right? So it was like, okay, so work backwards. So who are the people that do make money from this? So you're our heroes, for example. And it's like, right, why are they making money? And it's like, okay, well, they've created a brand, they've created amazing music, they've managed to sell themselves, they've obviously met other important people. Okay, how did they meet those people? Well, they went to these kind of places, or, and you just keep going backwards until he gets quite detailed. So it was like, right, okay, so we're at a very small level. No one knows who the hell we are. Okay, who's the next person up from us that has any power or any network or any influence? The guys that work in record shops in Manchester and city centre, okay, because they have access to the other producers that give them the records, and they know, there's no way of getting to the big people yet, but they know, they're like a little bridging gap. And I can physically speak to them because I can go and buy records. So we'd spend months trying to befriend these people more than your average punter, so that we'd have a bit of a like, oh, hey, Dave, you're right, mate. Can you, any chance one day you can link me up, you know? And that kind of like mad sort of strategic plotting started to go on. And that's just one example, but we used to spend a lot of time, as well as trying to learn our art form, but working out how to basically move up this like long ladder. And that isn't always fun. And that's, you know, you get rejected a hell of a lot, and, you know, it's difficult, and more time than not, you're getting slapped in the face, and it's kind of, you're spending a lot of time without any money, any income, you know, sort of basically on the dole. Our mums are like, what the hell are you doing up there? You know, this is, you know, when are you going to come back to London and get a real job? And, you know, our friends are starting to make money and stuff. And so those times are stressful. But I also think those times, you know, we were connected before on a sort of, you know, joint passion, you know, similar interest. And now you connect on a level of like, I need you and you need me. And suddenly my mum was like, and how's Saul doing? Is Saul all right? Is he still doing well? And, you know, his mum is well, okay. You know what I mean? Because it's like you are reliant on each other now to basically have an income and have a living.
And I think something that's important that kind of predates lots of that is one's quick to forget that actually two base things that drove this. So we got to know a lot of the guys in the record shops before it became like, you know, and that'd be a smart play, was just because we were obsessed with the music, and therefore going into record shops 5 days a week and getting as many promos as you can and knowing everyone. So when the promo comes in, yes, Saul, what's good? You're like, that's my brother. Thank you. Yep. I don't need it, but I'll have it because it's a white label. You know, like it was the passion, the crazy love about it. And something that really spurred us to like, right, let's do this. As before, I think we thought it's a monetary, you know, option is, we're good DJs. We thought we're good DJs. We want to, if we give you give us the opportunity to play in this nightclub main slot, we'll smash it. We know it, but no one's going to give us the opportunity. How can we do that? How can we get noticed? How can we get known? And then everything else became a part of it. And that fundamentally led to us saying we need to make music.
You go from befriending the people that work in the record store, and we're sitting here now, and the awards and the record sales and the gigs you've played, you know, we're talking about the biggest venues around the world. That's a leap. So I'd love to know the story of how you go from saying, do you know an A&R guy in Manchester to us sitting having this conversation now. So what happened next?
Yeah, well, it's a long story, obviously. And
can you do it in about 20 minutes?
Well, sort of. I mean, it's a series of doors, basically, that you don't open, you kind of kick open.
And by the way, I ask this question because our podcast audience is full of people with a dream and an ambition and an obsession. But they believe, like many young people do, oh, I'm born in this. This is my box. This is my path in life.
Oh, right. Well,
there's no way through. And you guys are living proof that that's not the case.
Yeah. I mean, it was never not an option for us to do what we do. And I think people say, oh, you know, are you, a question we always get asked is, you know, are you always like sort of surprised at your success, and you know, have you always sort of looked at these crowds and these accolades and thought, wow, you know, how did we get here? And we sound really arrogant, but we always knew we'd make it. We always knew there was never a single doubt that we wouldn't get to where we wanted to be. And it wasn't, we weren't arrogant, we were full of self.
I'm full of self.
I think, you know, it wasn't like, yeah, we didn't.
That's
think,
the thing
we,
that you can believe that and still be full of self doubt.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't this sort of delusional, like, we're just better than everyone. It was just like, we will, because there's no other option for us. This is what we want to do. We love it so much. It's a long shot. Making money from music is quite, you know, probably high risk. But it was like, there's just, we'll just do anything it takes to make, there will just never be a time when we're not figuring it out. And whether that means we've got to make friends with a million record shop owners or do even more ludicrous stuff, we'll just do that. And it's fine. We'll just keep doing that. And eventually a door will open. And it's definitely easier with two people. I think, you know, it's a lot of tough times in that journey and a hell of a lot of rejection and doubt and like, oh my God, this is a nightmare. What are we doing? What are we doing? What are we doing? But in those super low times, you look at your partner and you end up laughing because like
someone else got your misery.
Yeah, you're in this. Yeah, at least
so
you're in it.
Can you give us an example
me.
Of like a really low time then of where you did call on each other?
Oh man, I think there's been a lot of times when. So probably actually the hardest times are when you start to get success and then you get a lot of. A lot more expectation and pressure in a way, because when you're just trying to start out, everything's a win because your base level is just loss. You're not winning anything. You're just nothing. So anything good happens is a win, and anything rubbish happens is just normal. And then you start doing really well, and it's like there's a chance to continue that, and the losses feel quite painful and. You know, rejection of maybe it's a song doesn't do well or a record label isn't happy with something or whatever it might be, a bad gig or something, you start, that sort of doubt creeps and you go, oh my God, we're going to go back to square one again. Can we keep this going now? And more money gets involved and more people are interested in it. And I think some of those times, particularly the sort of difficult second album, after our first album, I felt we'd built this thing up where we're very proud of, the second album was like suddenly major labels and big money, Universal Music were involved, and they were like, right, this is it, it's all on you now to become this big act. And we both just had a full on meltdown.
Second album syndrome is legitimately something that 100%. Most artists actually experience.
And we
why is that? So, I mean, I wouldn't come back to it, but
because
the idea of the second album.
The debut album, there you have nothing to lose, you can't believe you're making an album in the first place because. What are we doing making an album? Anyway, you made that first album. Oh, the album's done really well. And on the back of that album, which has went gold on independent, we've signed with a major. That's random. Anyway, and then you go to make the next second album, and part of you wants us to make the first one again, but you can't because you've done that. And you know yourself, we're not ones for just recreating what we've done over and over. We want to do something new. And we knew that, you know, there had to be bigger, better, we had different ideas and all of those things, and then trying to have that success and keep the original fans without alienating them, because the second album had a lot of more different genres on there than just drum and bass. First album had drum and bass, two dubstep songs and a hip-hop track. It was all very and met lots of instrumental music, and the second album was geared around our live show and it was different direction, you know, taking it up a notch. And
dangerous position there of like losing all you've built, all your original fans. Like, hang on, this isn't what we signed up to. You've sold out. That classic thing of like, you've
what's
sold
selling out.
And once if that happens, a lot of our peers were doing that at the time. We saw a lot of people sort of jump for the stars, miss. You can't go back to where you came from. You're in no man's land at that point as an artist. You're like, well, you're not cool anymore. You're not successful on a commercial level, so you are really screwed, really. And then you've really kind of lost it. And that's why you see a lot of artists have that flash moment and then just you never hear them again. And that was that moment. It was a really dangerous territory for us. It was like, this is make or break, 100%. If this album doesn't really go, we won't be able to go back to that last 5 years that we built up.
The cool
blood,
one,
sweat,
the ground
and tears.
Our base
and this,
world, you know?
Yeah, this fan base we'd loyally built up. This doesn't stick. We'll be isolated as an act, we felt, anyway. And the pressure of that, and trying to meet deadlines, managers going, you need this, and the record label being like, it needs to be more commercial, we need more singers, we're not really into that. All of that, you know, was a lot. And, you know, definitely at the time, if it had just been me on my own, I'm sure Sawns and trying to do that, it would have been probably too much.
Contract negotiations where things have been, you know, beginning of the career that were a little bit, you know, skew with, shall we say. And is it good to have your partner there? You know, it was a good cop, bad cop, also worked kind of well. Mm-mm.
But what's intriguing is that you described two types of pressure here. So when you start out and you say that you've burnt your boats, you've just decided that you're going to make money from music, and yet you seem comfortable with that pressure.
Yeah.
And yet when you've then started to make money, do you think it's something about, at first you've said you playing to win on that first album. On the second one, you're playing not to lose.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the first one, you've got nothing to lose, then you've got something to lose. You know, I guess it's kind of that, really.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a bit defeatist, really, because we don't want to lose.
Mm.
But believe me, you know, we wanted to win. Mm. We didn't want to just, this album's all right. We had to write, you know, big boy album, like make sure this is sick. Mm. And that's all that counts, basically, the way that this is sick. And hopefully with that, you know, get some success. And that obviously went on to be our biggest album to date and our most successful one, which I don't think was just born out of the fear of not losing. You know, we knew, like, we wanted... It was the birth of the live show as well for us, you know, and it all went hand in hand. And it was a real, like, a departure, I guess, from the nightclubs, and to show we are also, you know, a festival-ready act to make those kind of moments.
What I'm picking up a lot of here, though, is, like, you two are both very happy to take a leap. Like, walking away from university is a leap. Staying up in Manchester where you were rather than coming home and getting a job. Most people go, well, I'll go home and I can live for free. I'll get a job. And then once I've got a job for 6 months and I've got some money in the bank, then let's have a chat.
Yeah.
And whereas you're doing it the totally opposite way. You're kind of, I imagine you're living hand to mouth. You're hoping for the best. Then you go to a major label, another leap of faith. Then you decide, right, we've done that. What's next? Let's go and be an amazing live act. Where do you both think, whether it was your upbringing or pushing each other on, where did this spirit of risk-taking and taking leaps of faith come from?
I mean, I think weirdly, I mean, that's kind of like a part, we're both madly ambitious, right? And madly competitive as well, actually. Luckily, not too much with each other, which I think we couldn't exist if we were just constantly competing with each other, because it would just be stupid. But when coming through, we were competitive with our peers. We were very business, you know. It wasn't all like, let's go to the after party with the other artists in our scene. It was like, we're just about our business and we're basically trying to get above you in your business.
Brilliant.
We were really competitive.
But that's your industry, man. Well, people will eat you alive.
That's right. But you say that. You say that.
We love that.
It is quite. But also, you know, dance music, there is a reputation, you know, there's a lot of like partying and there's a lot of looseness in our industry. Electronic music, DJs, after parties, superstars floating around, you know, drugs, all that kind of lifestyle. When we were trying to make it, we were not about that at all. We were boring. We were so business with what we did. Part of that is the sort of competitive nature in us. And I don't really know where that comes from. I can't place it in myself.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's just, you know, it's inbuilt, you know.
But they were very ambitious and it was like, it wasn't like, let's just try and do well. It was, let's be the absolute best. That's the only thing that's good enough. And it sounds quite kind of arrogant, that, but I guess it was like, well, it's all or nothing sort of thing. And, you know, you can always be better, can't you?
It all comes from that competitiveness. You know, we entered the Culture Clash years ago with our team, Rebel Sound, and we won it quite handedly. That takes us back to the beginning. When we first linked up, our competitiveness was drawing tunes on each other. Okay, that's sick. I need to get that. You know, that kind of, where do you get that from? Yeah, where do you get that from? And that became it. I want to play a better tune than you. And even when we started DJing out as Chase and Status, it's like drawing a little mix on each other. Ah, oh, you've done that one, yeah? Okay. I do a good one now, you know. Sod him, yeah. You know, like, and then that became a bit less aggy, but it definitely was a big part of the start of it. I think that whole culture we're from, like jungle, drum and bass, the whole culture is that. It's clash. It's like drawing tunes on people, making a tune, playing a tune that people go nuts to, turning to someone else and saying, you know what I'm saying? That's a big part of it, I think, 100%.
But I love the clinical nature of this, that you're not getting, like, you're playing to thousands of people, you're creating adrenaline and these amazing vibes, and then you can switch off from that and go into business mode from when you walk back afterwards. So how did you sort of avoid getting seduced by the trappings of the success and the comfort blanket of people patting you on the back?
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't think on that front, we're just not those guys. We're not ones for praise or insults, really. You know, like we don't read comments, we don't read good things, we don't read bad things about us. It's just, none of it is healthy. You know what I mean? In the slightest, I don't think.
And lots of people say that. Yeah. Like lots of people say, oh, don't read the.
But they're lying.
I'm sure.
Oh, I've glanced at it, but I don't mean, I'm not here to be like, oh, wow, people. It doesn't matter. 100 people could say, you're amazing, And someone could say, you're terrible. And I'd be like, that terrible one's really made me feel away. That's annoying. Yeah, but 1,000 people said you're great. Forget about them. Who's this 1 7-year-old from, you know?
I think there's always more to be done. We always had this feeling, and still do, that there's always something more to be done. So it was always like, you know, straight out the gig, back into the car and get to the studio, get to the next gig. Not, oh, let's have a drink and celebrate that big moment. And a nice example of that, I think when we released our first album or first single or first song on vinyl, just like an underground dance release, might have even been an alias.
Yeah, it was 2003.
It was just completely like, probably like 100 copies pressed on vinyl, but it was our first moment on vinyl. And a friend of mine sent us a bottle of champagne and said, wow, you guys, are, you know, you're like 22, whatever, you've got a song on a record, like, well done. You know, I thought, oh, should we pop the champagne tonight? I thought, no, actually, because we just want to finish this thing for like, we had this other little thing bubbling away. And we, let's do that. Let's get on that record label, another little label, and then let's drink it. And we did that a month or two later. And then it was, oh, let's just kept going. And we still got that bottle of champagne. And it's sort of a nice sentiment of like, there's never a moment of like, we've done it. Never, ever feel like that. We never, ever. There's always like, oh, we still need to do this. We still need to headline that. We still need to do that. And that's kept us focused from getting caught up in the kind of, we're here, let's drink the champagne, let's, you know, lose sight of what we're trying to do.
It's a brilliant lesson, because actually along the way, the nice reminder for the both of you has been, and we all know of them, those acts who appear. We talk on this podcast, never get high on your own supply.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing.
Get high on their own supply. They are the last one at the bar. Yeah. They are drinking the champagne.
Yeah.
They don't make the recording session the next day. They do start to piss off the record label and whatever. 6 months later, they're gone and you're still there. And people are going, why are those two still hanging around?
Yeah.
And that's why I love this conversation, because people that listen to your music, love the music. They don't understand this work ethic, this drive, this determination, this constant focus on the process, not on the outcome. So is there an outcome? Is there a day where you would drink that champagne, do you think? Or are you totally happy never opening that bottle?
Well,
that's a victory in itself. Yeah.
The latter, I'll be totally happy not opening it.
Yeah, I guess it's almost now it's become more, the minute you're sort of a sad day of like, well, it's sort of stopping, you're stopping, right? There's nothing more to achieve. You know, I think now, obviously, we're less, you know, obsessed about, we have less boxes maybe to tick than we used to, obviously. And we do celebrate, you know, our successes now and again. You know, we're not as fiercely mental as we used to be. But, I don't know. I think as long as you still want to be working and performing at a high level, then I think the bottle stays shut really for us.
So what are the kind of, like, we use this phrase world-class basics. It's almost like the habits that you relentlessly focus on. What are the kind of world-class basics that if we came to watch you now when you're working, we'd have recognised it from back in the early 2000s?
It's a good question, because I guess there are like three main elements for us. There's DJing, the live show, making tunes themselves, and then working with artists in the studio for their music. They all take completely different skills, really. Obviously, we're very comfortable to making music, and we have maybe it together for a lifetime. And it's funny, it's hard to pinpoint, because you sing DJing, okay, performing all these people, it's really just, it's an extension of what we would have done in your bedroom.
Do you mean kind of traits that are sort of traits that kind of
behaviors, things that you do, things that you bring to the table?
I think something that maybe a key to our success that's consistent through all of that and is still kind of putting yourself in challenging situations and then turning up to them. And you see it time and time again, particularly in our industry, people can be flaky and not turn up, things get long, let's not do that actually, or allow that. We've never ever missed a flight, not gone to a studio session, not met up with someone who we're nervous of or a big name, or not put ourselves in an awkward work situation, in a weird interview situation, which sounds kind of basic, but you'd be amazed at how many people sometimes cop out when the going gets really tough. And just turning up, always just turning up, even when it's the last thing you want to do.
Being reliable, man.
Because we don't have to, right? We're self-employed, but we can choose our own destiny a little bit. And it's very easy. That's the danger of that is like, you know what, let's just make an excuse and allow this today. And then again, we just look at each other and go, oh, really though, shall we? And this, no, it's wrong. And some of the best stuff has happened from those times when you've gone in a room with people that you're like, oh God, I'm dreading this. And then obviously you come out and
so give us an example of that then, Will.
Well, I think high pressure really, really actually works for Will and I on every level, be it. There isn't a single album we've done where until we were given like the absolute deadline, that if you don't miss and get this deadline, the next year is over for you guys. When we've hit it, you know, we always need these targets to go to, or being put in situations out of our comfort zone, like going in when we went in with Rihanna for the first time in 2009. That's a good example because we were so much younger. I mean, but we were in the room with her making music and we didn't know what the hell we were doing. But, and she's, you know, her music doesn't sound like ours, but we basically co-produced half an album for her and did loads of stuff with her. And we just dove straight in. You don't get much more deep end.
So how heavy was the imposter syndrome?
Massive,
Well, massive. I think I have that all the time. You know, I talk to my wife about that actually, and forever, you know, self-doubt and questioning. Every session we go to, if it's for someone else, I mean, like we've made a whole load of beats beforehand, I'm anxious thinking, man,
they're not going to like this.
Both of these 12 songs that we spent ages making are garbage and we're totally out of sync. And there's not been a single occasion where that's been the case. And every time we play the songs and the artist likes them and says, oh, these are great, the relief is like, oh, my. Like it's never happened before. But that's always going to be the way, I think, you know. It's these high pressure works for us, I think.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based, and what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
How did you deal with the whole Rihanna situation and not allow yourselves to compromise yourselves through that fear?
Yeah, well, obviously you're equally excited as you are, you know, terrified. And, you know, we were completely terrified of making fools of ourselves or just not being good enough. And, you know, she was very excited to work with us. And it sort of summoned us down to this.
Which, if you've got imposter syndrome, is weird in itself.
Weird anyway, yeah. And you know, but, you know, it was very lovely about it and said, come down to a studio in London for 2 weeks. I'm coming down to bring I'm bringing Jay-Z, Beyonce, the whole team. We're all going to be based there. I want you in one of the main studios. We're going to roll through our whole team and make this album together. So this was a while back. Okay.
The first album.
We'll be there. I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, what we're gonna do. We don't, you know, we're not American pop producers. We're still writing drum bass, you know, dubstep and mad stuff back then. What the hell are we doing? And again, two people helps, look at each other as you're in the front door and you're like, I'm hitting it, and then you both just laugh. You're like, well, you go first, mate. And at least you're with someone else. If it all goes
we're in it up, together,
someone if someone needs a bit of a moment just to take a minute, the other person can just fill the void for a second. So that helped definitely. But I guess, you know, our ambition overrode that kind of like doubt, and it's like, this is your chance.
We'll
this
make
is,
it work.
This is what you've been, you know, fighting for. So you only get one chance really at this kind of level. So you either turn up to this and you walk through the door and you just lay yourself out and just not, you know, worry how it's going to go, or you just walk, you know, you make your excuses and you don't, and you'll live to regret it. And it obviously went brilliantly for us, and we got a lot of good stuff from that and learned a lot. But I think as a trait, we've always forced each other and ourselves just to always, always turn up. And that means sort of metaphorically and physically.
Because some of the language that both of you use about this all or nothing, you know, like this is our one shot, can often seem...
That's my trait.
It can sound quite extreme in terms of, for anyone listening to it. Have you ever had examples where it has gone wrong and you've realised that maybe that all or nothing wasn't what you feared it'd be?
I mean, I've had a couple of sessions where it's like they've been horrific, you know.
Released music we didn't like. We've had songs that didn't connect. We've had, you know, bad releases. And
so how did you process that?
They've had to happen. It's cliched, isn't it? To, you had to go through the losses to learn, so that they wouldn't make the same mistake again. You know, had to go to that dry session with it was ages away and like miserable to get there and like totally off sync, and I like, couldn't have been a worse connect. Why was it there in the first place? To know, not going to do that again. And then left, you know. Done it 100 times since.
Yeah.
With the same kind of answer. But you go back to what's the phrase? You keep going back to the scene of the crime each time, hoping for a different result. And sometimes you do get a different result. It's a risk you have to take, you know. You know.
I'm enjoying this conversation because I'm seeing so, there's like a mirror here for me. Mm. I mean, a very, very different life. But when I ended up on kids TV, I was exactly the same as you two. It was the environment where you had to fight and scrap be absolutely self-obsessed. Obsessed.
Yeah.
Totally absorbed. Totally determined, totally ready to be the person that makes the move. And then I ended up in Formula One and felt not dissimilar to how you felt at times in your career, that everyone was expecting a fail and a flop. The only way through is to find it within yourself, and it's not going to come from anybody else. It leads me to a question, because I reflect sometimes on my TV presenting career and think, could I have enjoyed it more?
Oh, yeah, but yeah. I mean, the answer is yes.
Do you know what I mean?
The answer is yes.
Big time.
You know, big time.
But then what would you not have had, though, in return for the enjoyment?
We'd still be at the bar, you know. And I think maybe that's a sacrifice that you have to make to get to a high level in anything you do, right? I think probably most people would say along the way, looking back, they could have maybe stopped and paused and just, you know, enjoyed the moment a bit more. But I think it's impossible to do that very hard to do that. And actually, it feels like you could say, well, was that a sacrifice? But I think that what you get in the long run outweighs maybe that small sacrifice. And, you know, trying to achieve your dreams or even get close to them is probably worth that small bit of sacrifice. And actually, are you actually missing out on that much? You know, I don't know. We've not been too bad. You know, we obviously have celebrated, but we have been quite single-minded about our our sort of obsession of being successful and doing well. And maybe that's a small sacrifice, but I think long run,
yeah,
I'd do it. I wouldn't change a thing.
Wouldn't
really.
Change, not a single thing. Even any of the things that went, you know. Like we say, like certain tracks shouldn't have been on certain albums of ours should have been shorter, this track should have been for someone else, not for us, blah, blah. But fundamentally, it's all led to this and where we are now and how we are with our families and everything, and I wouldn't change
it. I think that five studio albums?
This is about to be our sixth.
About to six be
on
our
its
sixth.
Way
yeah,
to
yeah.
an NME nomination, a Brit nomination. You've played the O2, you've won awards, you've had amazing hits. There's no party, there is no night out that would ever feel as good today as that story would feel when you sit here and reflect on it now.
Exactly, true, man. Yeah. Exactly. I think you take a quiet comfort rather than, you know, we don't need to do that, you know, to kind of acknowledge our successes. And I think, you know, we kind of know, you know, we're proud of each other and our work that we've done, and we just sort of quietly kind of acknowledge that rather than need to shout about it.
My eldest daughter, she's six. She's just starting to kind of understand, figuring out something about what I may potentially be idea of doing. She's, you're going to work again, Daddy? I'm like, I was here last night. And Mummy goes, Daddy makes music that people listen to and dance to. I'm like, oh, that's cool. And she's starting, and I'm like, okay, when they're going to start thinking I'm cool or like what I'm doing, then I might start, that might start, be a real like wow.
Fortunately, I'm gonna break it to you now, bro. They're never gonna be cool.
They will for a bit.
You will never be cool.
They will for a bit, but like that's an exciting feeling, you know, like wow, they might see this thing.
The
like,
legacy at least. Yeah.
See, but that's an interesting area that you talk about being parents and partners now, because that obsessive element that you had in your early 20s when you two single lads going out, how have you woven in being parents and partners? I married it up with this obsession of still.
Oh, you know what? My wife, she should be here. Yeah, should ask her what it's like living with me. You know, yeah. Oh, she's the poor girl. I mean, she's
got three kids.
she's great. I'm not easy to live with. I understand that. You know, I'm difficult. And yeah, I'm obsessive and all this, and the career is quite, you know, extra. So like this week, for instance, is our busiest week so far this year with sessions and interviews and so on and so forth. And it's also, you know, first week of half term. So she's just there with the kids who are stuck to her like glue, yeah. You know. But I think the obsession comes out with everything, even at home. Like I've got two dogs, I'm a crazy dog fuck person. And I walk them every single day without fail at the same time, without fail. And like the thing that goes through my mind, if I haven't walked them, even like I haven't walked them today because I got in late, all I'm thinking about is got to get back and walk them, like they need to walk, you know, like it goes everywhere, but it comes out in different places, you know.
So if your daughter started to develop some of these characteristics you'd recognise in yourself, like this obsessive nature or maybe the compulsive element, would you encourage it or would you look to maybe dive into,
you know, you just, I kind of understand, like, you know, there's not really, there's no choice. She's not thinking, oh, I want to be like this. I want to suddenly do that. It's like, it's inbuilt. So rather than be like, why are you doing that? You know, like, oh, I know why.
But also, let's have this conversation for a lot of people that think similarly to you. So is it can be a really valuable and useful element of your life. It gets stuff done.
Well, I think if we had to like talk about OCDs, I think Will is very fastidious and neat and perfectionist,
organized,
you know, and I'm a complete mess. But I have
different, isn't it?
But yeah. My OCD is like, you know, I remember a conversation we had like 3 years ago, word for word, and like send him it. You know, I'm no details, things like that, like to the point. And like, he's very particular like that, and I'm messy, but obsessed with things. It's two different OCDs, ways, yeah. But they kind of work together.
And when you perform live, which I don't know whether you would agree is like the way to see Chasing Status,
yeah, definitely,
right?
Man. Yeah, yeah.
How controlled is that?
Well, I mean, it's a big production, which is quite technical. So we're trying to fuse electronic music with live music and
visuals
and in the same production as well, which is, yeah, visuals and lighting and stuff. So it's quite controlled in the sense that we're not an acoustic band jamming on a stage that can just flip between songs whenever we want, stop, start. You know, there's a controlled sense to the show. It's quite rehearsed, basically. I think that goes along with probably the genre of the style of music and what we're trying to do in that sphere. But we definitely run a tight ship with the crew, and there's, you know, 30 people involved with a live show, and our manager is equally controlled, and, you know, that's why we work well with her. And, you know, she's obsessed about the detail and working with other people like that. And so I guess that's, you know, we wouldn't be this successful without brilliant people helping us. And we recognize the same traits we have in other people, that attention to detail and obsession about getting things really to a proper level. Those are the people we tend to work with. And because of that, I would say we've been very blessed with amazing people throughout our lives, whether it's our lawyer or our accountant, our live production manager, or our agents. They're all kind of similar to us in varying ways. But so that's something we hold dearly, yeah.
This is when it sort of changes a bit, because when it's just a duo, there's only one other person's emotions to take into account. And if you offend that person, it's kind of okay to go and say sorry and it's done. When you talk about doing the live show with this amount of staff, you know, the two of you and your manager, you're kind of like the CEO, the MD and the COO of a business at that point. Yeah. So I'm really interested how you share the messaging with the people that are not on the stage and aren't getting the adulation and won't be making the big bucks from the show, or the people that aren't good enough. How do you deal with that? And how do you put a team together? Fascinated by that.
I guess our agent as well is literally the sort of CFO or COO as well. He's someone we've been with since the very start. And
say the start from back in Manchester?
He's our first agent from 2004.
Yeah, it's sort of literally the, you know,
the backbone of our entire life career.
And our lawyer, I guess we are good at letting people get on with their jobs. Once you trust someone and you know they're awesome and on the same kind of level as you,
it's like, and they cool. get to
you,
know you.
You
well.
Just do you then. What we don't do is we don't kind of micromanage too much, and we're not always in people's business. And we're like, I think the controlling nature that we talked about isn't, we don't try too much to control everyone else around us all the time, which, well, I guess we have in the past. I've been probably guilty of that. And you can definitely see that that doesn't react well. And you actually just start messing everyone up. And so we definitely let a team that we love and know now just get on with it. And that's lovely for us, because it means we can get on with our work and have full trust in the people around us to make difficult decisions.
What do you think, Saul?
Yeah.
Is it harder with your obsession? Like sometimes when you see people not
to let it go.
Well, you know, it's kind of like, yes and no. Like I notice a lot of things. Like if things are like incorrect or something, I'm always the
you're,
one. To,
yeah, you're.
I'm always the one to notice it. You know, like that's a typo. We can't put that out. Da, 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 you name it. I'm that eagle-eyed on that.
You keep people on your toes.
On their toes. On their toes. That's for sure. That's definitely.
How do you do that?
Is that a quality? I just
by being obsessed with absolutely everything.
Yeah. So I know. You know, I could on all elements, I'm always quick to know. Like these are the wrong track listing. This is the wrong order. That's the wrong thing. That's a full stop. That should be a comma. All that kind of annoying stuff. But what I don't actually, like Will said in the micromanagement, is I'm not telling my agent how to do his job. I don't know, he's the best agent in the world for me, so he don't, you know, I basically like, what do you think, Obi, should we do this? He's like, yeah, well, no, I don't think so. And I'm like, I agree. Generally we agree. If we don't agree, believe me, I'll say so. But it's all about kind of controlling the things that I feel that I'm able to have a genuine input on and not be like talking rubbish. And if it's something that I have really no clue about, I'm like, I'll trust the experts. And if it's one of us, you know, if Will's like, no, I know, I'm like, cool, I'll follow your lead on that.
So can I ask you about the dynamic between you two? Because like I'm getting echoes of an interview we did with an entrepreneur called Holly Tucker, who founded a business called notonthehighstreet.com, where she spoke about her and her business partner. She described them as the yin to their yang.
Course,
so one of them was creative.
Yeah.
One of them was brilliant at the detail of running the business.
Yeah.
Is it as clearly defined as that between you two?
Not probably as clearly defined, but I mean, we're definitely yin and yang. I think, you know, people have mentioned that and we talk about that a lot. Saul also said earlier on, good cop, bad cop, which, I mean, probably less so now. You know, we're probably more similar now than we used to be, but
And I'm softer, as I know.
Yeah, exactly. But
were you the bad cop song?
Yeah,
still
yeah.
am.
Yeah,
but like it used to be like, what was that?
The film? Worst cop. Yeah?
But it was that, where's his name? Harvey Keitel's a really bad.
Yeah, I mean
that one.
Bad cop, bad lieutenant, whatever.
Yeah, that's it. No, maybe not quite. Yeah, that was a film, but that is a deep.
It definitely. The good cop bad cop thing is great because. Obviously sometimes it's nice to get on with people and, you know, work with people on that level, and sometimes it's good to let people know that you're not going to be a pushover. And probably if it's up to me, you know, I'm probably too nice and could particularly back
it's reverse
back,
now mate, back I'll tell
the,
you
yeah it's probably reverse now, but you know
I'm soft and he's unbelievable
it, particularly when you're trying to make it and you know, get out of that difficult phase where everyone's trying to do the same as you, and it's
people try it's to take the mick at the start get, a couple of people tried it
over. You get walked all over all the time it. And exactly, and so you know Saul was very good at being like I don't think so, you know, this is what we want. And it was, you know, real cheeky stuff, like
what saying, sort of stuff?
Well, just
don't try not give you advances or like agreed in advance with one of us. And then as the thing is coming along, the advance isn't the same. I'm like, we agreed this, we all heard the conversation. And for me, well,
but especially speaking to our people way above our pay grade.
We're just
thinking they could just sort of say, you know what, you two are done.
Yeah.
And, and like, he was there going, I don't give a damn. Trust me, this, and I was like, oh brilliant. My God, you know, this is not going to end well for us. And it always ended well
time.
For us.
And it's because for me, and it's led to us getting a lot of calls from our peers saying, hey, can I get a bit of advice here and that? And the simplest advice is, we took for ourselves is, if you go into this game, into this world that you love so much, just desperate and grateful to be given the opportunity that like they're so high and mighty and your music is just, thank you so much for having it. It's the wrong attitude to have. You need to know your worth. And like straight away, just be like, well, this is maybe not the remuneration of it. Just like, this is worth something more than that. And you're not having it until we get what we want. And if you want it, you can have it. If you don't, it's all good. And with that, people will be like, fair enough. Let's talk. Rather than like, oh yeah, I gave so-and-so the song for free because I'm so pleased to be on X and Y. I'm like, great. You'll never get paid ever. You know, you got to start where you mean to go on, basically. And that was important for us.
So did you two ever sit down and formally agree what type of roles or characteristics?
No, not really. I think, you know, we tried, and then it's kind of pointless. And you know, when you work so closely together and it's a small setup, you don't, it kind of, it either works on that sort of other level or it doesn't. If you try and stick to these kind of rules written down, agreed, things get a bit stiff, and then if someone doesn't, and then it's like, well, you didn't do that, and we said, and you end up bickering about the detail. And I think at some point you just have to trust that each other, it's not always perfectly 50-50. Sometimes someone else does more of the work, sometimes that will swing around, and then another time, you know what I mean, you can't always put everything like, right, you're doing exactly that and I'll do exactly this. Otherwise, you spend so much time manifesting.
I did more than you there. You did more.
But I mean, the reason I ask is because you made the comment, Will, that like that you've changed. So
yeah.
That Saul was a bad cop, and now you said, well, actually, it's probably more of me. So so you've obviously adapted as you've been working together for so long.
Maybe it's bad cop and nastier cop.
I think, I mean, I think, again, you know, when we were starting out, things were way more intense with our working relationship. It was just me and Saul, right? We did everything. We managed ourselves. We were basically, we did everything.
We lived a street from each other.
We were managing our entire careers. Now we're blessed to have a big team of great people taking that pressure off us. So really our work is a bit more fun and creative and like, right, how do we make cool tunes again? We're not so worried about the strategy and, you know, we're across it with our team, but it's not reliant on me or him to sort of pull our fingers out and get it right. And so it's a bit, yeah, we don't have to have that sort of intense kind of working relationship as much as we did.
As you get to this sixth album, do you both get this sense that you're maybe working with more freedom than ever before because you have got people to carry that load?
Kind of.
You have achieved an incredible amount. Like literally you could never do another day's work and you've been a success.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I mean, that's almost like where the name came from.
That's really.
I think we got to a point after our last album and the time thinking about life through lockdown and whatever and reflecting and stuff and just thinking like, wow, we have kind of come full circle to a point where we feel now we can make music and do what we love doing with the freedom that we had when we were in Manchester without anything to lose. And without the pressures of that second album or the career to maintain or the business side of it getting involved, we sort of got to a point where it was like, wow, we've had an amazing legacy and career and amazing 15 years of experiences that we treasure, and let's use all of that to sort of go back to how we felt at the start. And that's where the album title came from, What Came Before. It's kind of like what came before was just the freedom to do what we love doing without thinking about anything else.
Listen, we've reached the point where we go into our quickfire questions. This will take double the time it normally does, so it won't be particularly quickfire. And I'm looking forward to the first answer to this one, which is your three non-negotiables that you have to deliver and the people around you have to deliver. What are the three things that you always bring to the table?
Kind of traits. Being on time.
On time.
Yeah. Being clear communicator.
Does that count as being reliable? On time, yeah, it's the same, isn't it?
Kind of. I mean, being...
Yeah. You're allowed six, by the way, because there was two of you.
Okay, yeah. Reliable, because we're definitely reliable. Yeah. We're pretty much on time.
I think for me, communicating, things can get really complex, and people that can't communicate simply...
Keep it simple.
Very simple, simple.
Keep things simple, yeah. Less is more.
Yeah. What else?
Honest. Honesty, being I think honesty, has to be the yeah. first, man. The absolute
You'd have that as
first.
Number one, would you?
I think I would have it. Honesty. Because, yeah. you know, with me personally, it can obviously get me in some situations, but just, it has to, I mean, more to the point, but being honest, yeah. just be straight
but
with
does
us.
It doesn't
be
matter straight if with it us. Gets you into a situation,
no, it doesn't.
If it's honesty.
It doesn't, just be straight, yeah. whatever it is with us. You're not happy with something, you are happy with something, great. Every now and again, it's nice to hear that you're happy. But like, yeah, if you're not happy, we want to know immediately. Please don't, you know, don't hide it or go elsewhere and say it. Just, we're here and we, and what is it? What's the word for if there ever is a situation, we always want to sort it out. If we make a mistake, we're quick to realize it, you know, and like take accountability.
What advice would you give to a teenage Will and a teenage Sol just starting out?
Don't wear your ponytail so tight because one day your hair's going to be a bit thinner and you'll be really upset about it.
There's the truth right there.
That's it.
Yeah.
Again, I know it's so cliched and horrific to say, but like, if we changed anything we did, be it going to the Rays back then, to Bagley's, to editing at Manchester, I wouldn't change a thing.
I tell you what, maybe I'd say, you know, to young me, like, if you can, you know, try and find someone else that's into what you're into, and try and do something with them, because it's definitely being on your own is tough, and I think every successful person has someone with them, whether they're in profile or not. There might be a quiet partner or something, but to be on your own, particularly as a forward-facing artist, is tough. And so find someone that you can build something with and work with.
Anything to add, Sol?
One decision that we made, I think, that for Will and I made, that actually I think was the real fork in the street one, where you can either go this way and go the long way around, because we knew we were going to make it anyhow at some stage, or, okay, this is how it's going to start. Move you boys now, is came down to Manchester with the dub plate, went to Black Market Records, paid for the DJ in there, and he took the dub plate off me, and he said, if I can keep this, I'll play it tonight at Fabric. I called up Will. He was like, what is this mad thing to do? Why are we doing this? We discussed it for me, then decided it's a good idea, gave the kid the thing, thought I'd never hear from him ever again. 3 a.m. that morning, phone call for kid at Fabric, people going crazy. Bam, 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 my sister wants to talk to you. His sister ended up signing the record for us on the Monday. Our lives changed. We were like, this is going to happen. This is starting to happen. And it would be to remind myself, the young me, of that moment, because you forget those things. And actually, like, taking that real punt. Like, we'd driven down to Manchester for 3 hours, gone to a dub cutting house, cut that for ages, spent our last few quid on it, gone to Black Market Records, paid to this geezer, and I've given it to him. My friend who drove me there was like, you are an idiot. I've driven you all around the country and you've given the thing away. Get out my car. Like, pretty much livid. And it was just remind myself, you know what? Sometimes you've got to take that scary leap. Because if we didn't take that leap, which at the time it was a big leap for us. Like I said, you know, it was a wasted trip coming down from Manchester, spending all our money. We didn't have 50 quid at all. And that leap ended up, you know, being the start of it. So it's
a really good lesson as well, that for people listening to this, because people will be thinking, right, okay, I understand this now. I'm going to be like the guys. I'm going to really believe it's going to happen, but I'm going to marry that belief with an incredible work ethic, unbelievable attention to detail and strong communication. But you know what? The thing that changed your entire careers was totally out of your hands. You didn't control that moment. You didn't know that moment was going to happen. And that is also a really important lesson for people, is like, the universe has to play a part in all of this as
well.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It takes a risk.
You've got to go and do it. Just
chuck yourself in the deep end. Yeah, and who knows? Who knows?
Next question is, how important is legacy to you both?
I think it is important. It wasn't, and now it is. And I guess we're proud of what we've done. And we've seen so many people, like I mentioned earlier, come and go, which is really sad. Lots of our friends, lots of our peers of who we thought were going to become huge and sort of go on to have careers have kind of suddenly disappeared and you know, for whatever reason, maybe intentionally, but it's tough to kind of keep things going. And I guess things do end someday. And I would be probably most proud of getting to the end of this journey and ending on a high, not one of these spectacular bands that fall out with a label or fall out with each other or kind of things get a bit neggy at the end. And I would love to, the day we decide, okay, we're not going to do this anymore, for it to end on a real high. And then at that moment to, you know, maybe open that bottle of champagne and go, hasn't been such a bad journey after all.
I think I'm already kind of proud of where we're at, and I've only realized it in the last few months. Like, because it's dawning on me that, you know, it's 20 years next year. And it's like, wow, we actually have done quite a bit. And to the extent that I do feel, you know, if after the pandemic, the clubs opened, we were allowed to DJ again. The amount of shows that we had was very humbling. Like, it was so many. And it was like, wow, people really do want to see us. And, you know, we still have a great fan base. And that was without any new music. So, you know, I'm excited for hopefully it's a legacy of great albums still to come. And the beauty about what we do, I think, is that when we do decide to no longer perform or, you know, be the band or whatever, there's still so many parts of the music industry and the career that we can work in, producing for other people and constantly making music. I don't think there'll be actually a day, popping that champagne or not, where Will and I won't be making music. I think it's intrinsic to us. It's in us. It's a release. You know, it's an outlet that you need. And I think, you know, as long as that's inside us, we'll always be creating.
If you could go back to one moment in your life, what would it be and why?
There's been a few moments that are all kind of similar in the sense that the phone has rung. This is, again, us professionally starting out and, you know, desperate to try and prove to ourselves that this could even work. And a few moments where the phone has rung and someone on the end of the line has said something to us that has been so exciting, you know, basically had picked up the phone and said yes, and had that unbelievable out of world experience of like the most exciting thing has just happened. And whether that was a record label sort of saying, guys, you know, I'm so-and-so and I want to sign you to a big deal, and from, you know, no artist. One. Yeah, or a big artist we worshipped and looked up to would call us and say, I want to work with you guys. Those moments when you're starting out are unlike any other moment, you know, even more exciting than when we headlined sort of Glastonbury to 65,000 people, yeah, which is out of body experience. But those moments when you got an email or an AIM, an AOL instant message, or as I said, a text message.
Or MySpace.
When we were 23 years old, a message from someone saying, yo, I've just heard this thing. I want to meet up. And, you know, we would be on the floor with excitement and energy, and like that feeling is, I don't think we'll ever feel that level again.
It was very personal as well, because those moments were just happening with us. You know, Will and I, on there was one occasion
that can't share
was a phone
else,
call, yeah, like for 3 a.m, like, what the fuck? You know, like, yeah.
Someone saying, I'm gonna do this with you guys, and I wanna make this work.
I mean, obviously the rush of playing to 80,000 people, whatever, is like, wow. But this is a very different, very personal, very like, understated moments that we've had there with on the phone, definitely.
And the final question for people listening to this is kind of your last message, really, and it is your one golden rule for living a high performance life. What is the one final thing you'd like to say to the listeners and the viewers from this conversation?
For me, it's learning the art of collaboration, and whether that's collaborating with the million artists we work with, through just the physical nature of making songs with other people, whether it's collaborating with all the people we run our business with, or whether it's collaborating with each other. And it's a really difficult thing to do well. I think probably it's an art form in itself, but if you do it well, I think it's probably the most powerful thing you can do. And I'd like to think our career is a testament to that.
Yes. And honesty and dedication, they will get you very, very far.
Mm.
You know, you can all in this, you can always work more when you're younger, especially. You don't realize it at the time because you're just in your life. But as you get older and you get responsibilities and families and pets and kids and everything, and you have less time.
Yeah.
So when you have that passion, that fire in your belly, that like those like blinkers that nothing else you can see past, but doing this, the blinkers, sorry, just got to run with it. And we sacrificed everything to do it at the time. We weren't going out to nightclubs, bars, like linking up with our girlfriends, nothing. We were in studio 23 hours a day, and it was all like sacrifice for the one day we'd be able to do what we love. And that determination, I think, is very important.
Damien.
Jake.
I enjoyed that.
I loved it. There's an old story about a guy who invaded Mexico back in the 16th century, and his troops were complaining and they were nervous and they were worried about what they were going to face. And he sent one of his team back to burn all the boats on the beach. So the only way they could ever get home was by fighting their way through the difficulties. And that's what the metaphor came to my mind when I was listening to both Will and Saul talking about there, that they burnt their boats. They went all in to go after success. As they said, they knew they were going to be successful. It was just how they were going to get there.
And that line they said numerous times, we knew we were going to be successful. I think it's really important we just pick at that a bit, because what they're not saying is we were arrogant and we believed it was just going to happen for us. They spoke about it almost as like a superpower, so that the fact they knew they were going to be successful allowed them to quit uni. It allowed them to stay in Manchester. It allowed them to put themselves in situations that most people wouldn't be in. But most importantly of all, it allowed them to work hard. Because I think that in the back of their minds, they're going, man, you're working hard. Man, you're sacrificing. Man, you're never going out and having fun. But then that voice goes, yeah, but you're going to make it as a music artist. So this is fine. And it was a really positive, we knew it was going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's that last bit that you've just nailed there, Jake, around they were working hard. They weren't just dreaming about making it big and hoping that somebody would spot them or somebody would hear them playing music in the bedroom. They were working hard at getting better at the craft. And then the story of going out and meeting the guys in the record shops, the understanding that they had to create a brand, they had to create a buzz around what they were doing, is the important bit. That having a dream without doing the hard work is only ever just going to be a dream.
And I think there are quite a few platforms, you know, and some podcasts included, that are peddling this dangerous message of whatever walk of life you're in, just go and make it happen, just go and do it. And I think that it's, you could mistake them saying we knew it was going to happen for that same level of ignorance or arrogance, but actually it's not at all what they're not saying. It's just going to happen for them. It's going to just happen for everyone. They are absolutely laying it bear to us that they worked and worked and are still working even today. And I think that, you know, we've said on so many occasions, this podcast sort of lifts the covers. So you really see the truth behind someone's career. When you look at Chase and Status, you hear the music, you look at the big events. Now, you know, the work that went into them.
Yeah. There's a brilliant book by a guy called Stephen Pressley, I think, called The War of Art. And it's about, you always show up. You don't wait for inspiration to descend. You go in and you do the work and inspiration follows. That you never miss an appointment time. You turn up and you apply to everybody that's in the studio you're working with. And that's what Will and Saul were telling us there, that it was about the hard work. They never got high on their own supply. They'd do a big show, they'd be successful, and they were going away and planning, how do we do that better? They were doing that analysis.
And for those people that are listening to us talk now thinking, well, how does this apply to my life? I would say that the hard work allows you to fail and it allows you to not be successful. Because if they release their most recent album and it doesn't sell, or they go on tour and people don't buy tickets, they can still say, well, you know what? We gave it 100%. We were laser focused. We were obsessed about it and it wasn't to be. It's a hell of a lot better than thinking, I wish I'd worked harder.
Yep. There's a great saying that they use in the New Zealand rugby team, that the worst thing you can ever be is a one-cap wonder, because you've demonstrated you've got the talent, but you didn't have the perseverance and the characteristics to stay there. And I think the fact that these guys are on their sixth album, they're hugely successful. It's not just the talent, it's the hard work and all those characteristics they've shared with us that defines high performance.
Right, Damien, it's time for our favourite part of any high performance episode, time to speak to the people that are listening. And we've got a really lovely message this week. Oh, by the way, if you want to reach out to us, then head to High Performance or to Damien or myself on Instagram, ping us a message, let us know why you love High Performance, what it is it's done for you, and what you'd like to share on the podcast, because that's exactly what our next guest did, who sent us a message saying, I just want to say how much I love listening to the podcast. I was late to the party and only really started listening a few months ago, which means I still have loads to catch up on, which we always think is a good thing. Damien and I love that. This person says, I love the variety. Some of my favourites have been Joe Malone, Kelly Holmes, Joe Wicks, Kevin Sinfield, and probably my absolute favourite, Lee Childs. I'm about to retire in June after 25 years, wow, of primary teaching. And I love the way that Lee acknowledged the challenges and important roles that teachers play. I've been inspired by many of your guests, and listening to your podcast has given me the final push I needed to realise a long-term ambition. Well, I think it's time to find out what the ambition is and meet the listener joining us today. Hello, Chris.
Hi there. Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm great. From sunny Edinburgh.
So tell us then, Chris, how has listening to the podcast changed the way that you think? Because what we love to say to people is that we're all constantly evolving and changing humans, right? So you could easily go, well, I've been a teacher for 25 years. I've lived a wonderful life. What more can I learn? So I love the fact that you still came to the podcast and grew and developed and learned lots of new ways of thinking. What was it for you that grabbed you?
Yeah, I think, kind of what started it off was during lockdown. So I've read all my life. I love reading. It's like a really big thing for me. And I've written stuff for about 10 years. And then during lockdown, two things happened. First of all, I was furloughed for a few months, which I took really hard. And then the second thing was that we got a kitten. And I also do a lot of mindfulness too. So I teach mindfulness to children. I teach mindfulness to adults. And I've had some of my meditations published on Insight Timer, the app. But during lockdown, I started writing some for children, mostly because my colleagues were saying, you know, we're online with, you know, some of the children, because I'm not a class teacher. I'm a support for learning teacher. So I teach children with learning differences. So that's kind of where the children's writing started, I guess. We got the new kitten and we were just watching her do stuff, or, you know, scared to do stuff. So the first time we put her out in the garden, she wouldn't go, you know. So it kind of thought, maybe I could do some mindfulness, not particularly for her, but it just gave me the idea that maybe, you know, I know that children are scared of things and, you know, they struggle to do, you know, certain things. So I thought, why not make it into a story? And I was originally just going to put it up on Insight Timer as a story. And then it kind of became a little bit more than that.
So would you tell us where the High Performance podcast came into that then, Chris, and how that helped you?
So, well, the first one I actually listened to, because one of my colleagues kept saying, you have to listen, you have to listen. And I listened to Kelly Holmes, and she was a real inspiration. And, you know, I really liked the 20%, 80% that she talked about. And I just thought, you know, these are ordinary people doing extraordinary things. So that it kind of inspired me to keep going. I mean, I had written it, but I'd been knocked back by quite a few publishers. And then I saw an advert for self-publishing and I just thought, I'm going to go for it. And it's kind of my big birthday present to myself, if you like.
Now, Chris, I do not want to offend you, but I would love to ask how old you are, with you set to retire in a few weeks' time.
I'm 59 just now, so I'm not at the big 6-0 yet.
Now, one of the things we often say to people is an old Stoic phrase, which is, when's the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago. When's the second best time? Right now. And I think we live in a world where too many people, we get messages, Chris, from people in their 30s saying, I've missed the boat, I've missed the chance, it's too late for me. I would love you just to share a message with our high performance community as someone who is approaching a big birthday, just to sort of share with us the thought from someone with your life experience that it's never over. The journey continues all the time.
Yeah, just go for it. Be brave. I wish I'd done more when I was younger. I wish I'd had more courage, but I kind of trod a sort of more traditional path. You know, I didn't push myself out of my comfort zone too much. And I think as you get older, you kind of think, well, it's now or never. You know, there's, you never know, do you?
That reminds me of a great phrase, Chris, that a guy called Dr. Daniel Amen used to say, that at 18, we spend our time worrying what people think about us. We get to 40 and we go, oh, I don't care what people think about us. And then when we get to 60, he says, we then realise that nobody was actually thinking about us after all anyway.
I would agree. I think it's true. And I like his stuff. I've read some of his books on ADHD. And
brilliant. Look, Chris, we wish you all the very best with the picture book. We wish you the very best with retirement. Thank you for all the hundreds of young lives that you would have touched over the years as a primary school teacher and the changes that you made to their lives. And thank you so much for realising the value that exists in the High Performance Podcast and coming on and sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
What a nice conversation that was, Damien. You know, it reminds me of, have you heard the George Eliot quote?
Go ahead.
And I'll probably get it wrong as I usually do. And it's something like, you're never too old to become what you might have been.
Oh, I love that. That's a cracker.
And that's like, let's stop living in this world where we kind of either decide it's too early or too late or it's not the right time in some way, because this is a conversation about delaying our happiness. And it almost feels like, you know, Chris has realised that you're never going to get this time again and to chase those dreams. And I love that.
Yeah, I think it reminded me a little bit of our conversation we had that with Mary Portas, where she was just saying it's never been easier to be an entrepreneur. You've got access to like the World Wide Web in your hand. And I think for Chris there to realise that anyone can be an author, if you've got the passion, you can go down that self-publishing route and still get your book out there and share it with the world. So yeah, you're right. I think it's such a really powerful, affirming conversation with Chris.
It's funny you say that, you know, because one of the common conversations that I have at the moment is with young people saying to me, oh yeah, but it was much easier back in the day when, you know, you got into TV because there was less challenges and it's harder now than it's ever been. And I, do you know what I say to them? Genuinely, there's never been more opportunity for anyone to do anything they want to do. And the answer is our mobile phones. The answer is Instagram. The answer is YouTube. The answer is TikTok. You know, let's say you're super passionate about curtains. You can just create content. You can create a YouTube channel. You can create an Instagram account. You can create a podcast. You know, this whole thing that we're on now, this High Performance Podcast, it's just born out of passion and a love for something. And anyone can do that about anything in their lives. And it can be a side hustle or it can be your whole life. But what it can't be is ignored and put in a box and pushed away, because I guarantee you when that final breath leaves your body, you'll think, why didn't I just do that?
Absolutely. And I think Chris, like all our guests in many ways, are echoing the same thing of just give it a go. You're smarter for the experience and you're wiser for it as well.
And I love the fact that she appeared on the same episode as Chasing Status. And there might be people thinking, how does Chris, age 59, from Edinburgh, link that closely to Chasing Status? But go back to the conversation we had with them, Damien. It would have been easy to not stay in Manchester, easy to go home, easy to stick with doing a degree. But they just decided to put passion and purpose at the centre of what they did. And that's led to their amazing career.
Yeah. And you know what? I think Will and Saul would listen to that discussion we've had there with Chris. And they'd find an awful lot of common ground with her. They wouldn't be, you know, having met the guys, they were real committed to their art, but I think they respected others that had that passion as well.
And it's been a couple of weeks since we recorded that conversation with Chasing Status or Will and Soul. And I actually, they were really warm characters, weren't they? I keep thinking back to what a nice kind of feeling it was in the room.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought they were brilliant. I thought they were really sort of self-aware. But in many ways, this sounds insulting. It's not intended to be, but they sort of embraced their inner geek as well, didn't they? They weren't trying to be cool. They weren't trying to be sort of edgy. They were just happy to embrace, this is who we are. We're passionate about music and making music.
Join the club.
Yeah.
Geeks rule, brother. listen, mate, thanks ever so much for your time. And if you're listening to Damien and I have this conversation and you have got the time to subscribe or share or rate this podcast, it means we can reach even more people than we have done so far. So we would love you to do that. You can also watch the interviews as well as listen to them. So if you want to see Chasing Status or any other guest that has joined us on High Performance over the years, then just head to YouTube, type in the High Performance Podcast, or get all the details at our website, thehighperformancepodcast.com. Damo, thanks ever so much, mate.
Thanks, Jake. Loved it.
Wonderful. And before we go, just thank you so much for the amazing reaction to the podcast with Greg Hoffman. Yodi said, "This week's High Performance Podcast with Greg is the most valuable piece of content I've consumed in years." Tanya says, "I've just listened. I'm replaying with my notebook later as there's so much for me to take away from it." Another great podcast with the former CMO of Nike talking about changing the structure of the marketing function to respond to the digital arena. So thank you so much for all those amazing comments and thoughts that you've had regarding the High Performance Podcast over the last few days. We don't take them for granted. Thanks to Will and Sol. Thanks to Chris. Of course, thanks to Damien and to Gemma and to Eve and to Will and to Hannah and to Finn from Rethink Audio. But most of all, the big thanks on the High Performance Podcast goes to you at home for listening, for sharing, for discussing and for helping this platform to grow. Just remember, there is no secret. It is all there for you. So be your own biggest cheerleader over the next few days and make world-class basics your calling card. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.